Join us as we gather around the hedge, where we dig into technology, business, and culture with the finest minds in computer networking.
Hello, Tom. That's a big fan you got behind you there, man. I never noticed that before. Yeah, does that keep the plants alive?
Maybe. I don't know. Well, it's turned off, so probably not.
We have this thing, Ian, about Tom's plants. He kills plants.
Yeah, but I've got this one. Check it out. It's still alive.
Wow. So, yeah. Amazing. This is like 2 months now you've had that thing.
I know.
You don't know it's not plastic.
No one's supposed to tell me that.
So today we're joined by Ian. Is it Getz? Is that right?
Yep. Getz will do. Yep.
All right. Good. And he is surrounded by Spitfires because he's in England. If you've ever watched Foyle's War.
It's not a national requirement.
I know. But if you've ever watched Foyle's War, you have a deeper appreciation for the Spitfire, even though I understand they use some of the wrong Spitfires in that, in the recordings.
I'm not even going to get into that. Because I could.
Well, like they used models that didn't exist at the time that the...
Yeah, like if it's got four blades on the prop and two radiator boxes under the wing, then it's a Mark 9 and it's too early. But
something like that.
Sorry, being an anorak now.
That's fine. So today we are here to talk about Spitfires and 5G and the relationship between the two. No, just 5G. So Ian, why don't you start right at the very beginning and just explain 5G to us and like what's supposed to be revolutionary about this? What are people looking forward to? Instantaneous network access, no delay, no jitter, infinite buffering. I mean, we've heard it all, right?
No delay, wow. Yeah. Right, so what is 5G? So as you know, we kind of kicked this off with back in the 80s with analog, basically FM radios. In America, you had the AMP system. In the UK, we had the TAC system. In the Nordics, you had the NMT system. And then the European countries under the old SEPT standards body, which is some great long French acronym for something, European Posts and Telecoms, basically said, wouldn't it be good if we had a common European radio system? And at the time, ISDN was being developed for the fixed networks. So 2G was created, GSM, based on an ISDN kind of framework. And we ended up with a system that where we could roam from one country to another. And we saw the explosion in mobile comms through the 90s. Now, the next thing they did was they added data capability to that. I say data, we're talking like 64K downhill with the wind behind it, if you were lucky. That was GPRS or 2.5G. Then somebody changed the modulation schemes on the radio and created Edge, which gave us up to, I think, 380-something K. And that was what AT&T initially launched as a 3G service, in inverted commas. Meanwhile, in the US, you were going through IS-54 digital amps and IS-95 CDMA and having the wars between Qualcomm and anybody else who, as to whether what was the right radio service and best quality for the American market. And then you had the PCS operators that moved in and launched GSM. You get into the late 90s, early noughties, and we all start moving towards 3G, and that was a wideband CDMA. So therefore, we moved from TDMA, where you had a carrier with 8 time slots on it, and you subdivided that carrier into the 8 time slots. You could get a half rate into 16 time slots. In wideband CDMA, you were given effectively a slot, but it was a code, and your traffic was spread into the noise floor of the radio and then pulled out using a filter at the other end. The difference effectively between CDMA and TDMA. So we get through 3G, then out comes 3.5G, which was high speed HSDPA, high speed data packet access, and then HSUPA, which was the uplink version as well. So you got that kind of asymmetry capability starting to come in. And at the time, we still had the architecture where there was a radio controller node. And in 2G, it was the BSC, base station controller, 3G, RNC, radio network controller. Big bottleneck.
So I want to interrupt you for 1 second.
Go on.
Broadband. Explain.
Broadband, explain. Well, that's where I was just about to get to, which is 4G.
Okay, I'm sorry. Explain what broadband 4G, means, because we don't have a lot of radio.
So what you find is each time you go from 1G to another G, it's driven by a need for capacity, and it's also driven by a need for governments to sell spectrum to people, he said, being cynical. So, you know, 2G was in the 900 megahertz band, 80 to 1800 megahertz. 3G was in the 2.1 gigahertz band. 4G was in the 2.6 gigahertz band. So each time there's a new block of spectrum to for governments to be able to agree the usage of in a particular technology and then license out. But it had to have a market driver. So 4G's market driver was mobile broadband and the idea that you could go and use the internet. It was to be driven more by data than it was by voice. Initially it did, but obviously to get to that easy use of data required the adoption of the kind of the app capabilities on devices. So you needed the kind of different worlds to collide of the 4G network with the smartphone, with the applications. And that was glued together initially in 3GPP by a system called IMS, which was IP multimedia subsystem designed to enable you to put data apps onto your phone, work with an application up in the core network, and have access to all kinds of amazing mobile broadband services. Except that almost to a person in the industry, we screwed it up because the operators have this kind of mentality of what's the one app that's going to pay for all this infrastructure for the data, the IMS system, forgetting it's about creating an ecosystem and enabling app developers to come and be innovative, i.e. the what is now known as the cloud model. So IMS didn't really take off in 2005, 2006, 2007. However, the concept of it did when this small West Coast fruit company came along in 2008 and launched the iPhone. And then a couple of years later, Google came along with Android and the rest is history. So, you know, we've now got multiple apps on everybody's phone. You can get access to anything. But of course, app developers don't code things to be radio efficient. They don't even code things to be memory and CPU efficient. So, you know, you get this now this kind of constant leapfrogging of needing more and more capacity. And therefore, we need 5G. Because the way in a cellular system you add capacity is you turn down the power and you repeat the cells more often. So whereas you would have had a 30-meter tower and then a few miles down the road, another 30-meter tower, and then a few miles down the road, another 30-meter tower, each one of those has got, if you think of a hexagon, 120-degree sectors, so three sectors on it, and you repeat your spectrum. So if you've got a X megahertz of spectrum in 4G, you'll have that divided down into the channel spacing. I can't remember. I think it's 25 megahertz in 4G. F1, F2, F3 on the first base station, 4, 5, and 6 on the next, 7, 8, and 9 on the next, and then back to 1, 2, and 3. And you balance that according to the power that you're transmitting at and how far it'll go before it's lost in the noise. And that's what's called the repeat pattern. The way you get more capacity out of that is you obviously turn down the power, drop in more cells in the middle between those towers, and you grow more and more sites. But eventually it gets to the point where the only way to really offer a better service is to come up with more radio spectrum with a new modulation scheme, which means you can do amazingly faster speeds. And that's when 5G comes in. So we move to a completely new radio modulation system. We go to a new network architecture, or initially a hybrid network architecture where we're using 4G for signaling, 5G for user plane. That's called 5G non-standalone, or NSA, which is pretty much what all the mobile carriers have launched at the moment. And then probably over the next 1 to 2 years, we're going to see that being replaced by 5G standalone, or SA, where all the signaling and all the user plane is on the 5G. And that's the essential change. It's being able to offer a more efficient radio with much higher bandwidth in new spectrum to generate more capacity. Now, that's the driver for it. You talked about low latency or zero latency. There's out there the 1 millisecond myth. And the 1 millisecond myth is that 5G will give you a 1 millisecond latency. There is a part of 5G called URLLC, or ultra reliable low latency communications, which you can only launch if you've got enough spectrum to do it. Not all mobile operators have. And that is a 1 millisecond air interface. So that is the 1 millisecond will get you from the radio in your device, not necessarily a handset, but a device, to the radio at the base station. The rest of the network's the same. You know, the speed of light in fiber and the delay introduced by routers and all that sort of stuff is exactly the same from the base station to wherever the core network is. So then the only other way you can reduce latency in a 5G system is by the technologies that have come in around ETSI, MEC, multi-axis edge computing, And the fact that in the 5G system, under the standalone core, you've now not got a user plane that's welded to the control plane of the mobile packet core, the EPC. You've now got a thing called a 5G standalone core where the functions for application management, the AMF, session management, the SMF, and the UPF, the user plane function, are disaggregated or can be disaggregated. So you can now take your UPF and put it as close to the base station as you like, and it will still be under the control via a signaling interface called the N4 back up to the core. Now, what that enables you to do is, in the mobile world, everything is carried in GTP. That's the encapsulation protocol. It's not just an encapsulation. It's not like IPsec around an IP channel or any of those things, or GRE or anything like that. It's basically GTPU and GTPC. GTPU, user plane, GTPC, control plane, signaling. It's carrying all of your mobility signaling for handover, for where you are, for paging, for all of those things. So you have to terminate that, and to terminate that on the user plane, you need a UPF. So you can put the UPF now closer to the edge of the network, the radios, terminate that GTP, deliver IP out the back end of it straight into an application server that's also running at the edge of the network. And that's where the term edge computing comes from. It's, you know, how does that give me an explosion in the industry? Well, it's basically enabling you to stop using wired networks, to use mobile networks, either in local buildings or campuses for private 5G to deliver things like industry, what's called industry 4.0. So replace your wired network around your production factory with a 5G system. You now get very low latency, very flexible. You can rejig the production processes without having to redesign your interior IP network every 5 seconds. And you get deterministic latency. So the MIST guys won't like this, but Wi-Fi does not have deterministic latency. And that's driven by a thing in the radio called a scheduler. Wi-Fi 6 has got a better scheduler, but it's still not as good as the 3GPP one. And that's what gives you, if you say, I want a bearer of 2 milliseconds, 4 milliseconds on the radio interface, it will always be 4 milliseconds. It doesn't vary with load. If you load up a Wi-Fi access point, the latency gets longer.
I had a question back on GTP before we get too far. So is this a link layer protocol similar to Ethernet? And this is what is between the base station and the handset? Am I understanding that right?
So you've got the radio protocols at the link layer, and then as you go up, you get to the GTP part of the stack. So GTPU, GTPC, what kind of layer? Tempted to say layer 3 and above.
So does IP run across this?
It runs inside the GTP.
Okay. So it's more like an MPLS almost. I would think.
Kind of, but
like it's a 2.5.
Yeah, but it's got signaling in there for session setup, mobility, handover, all kinds
LDP,
of people.
LDP, all of that stuff as well, right? But it is more connection-oriented because it's over a wireless, right?
Yeah.
So it actually has session setup and teardown and things like that that you don't have.
So you establish what's called a PDP context, and you terminate on a thing called an APN, an access point name, and that's the IP address on the IP side of that user plane. Now,
So two of the things that you kind of hit on there, which were one thing you hit on there, and another thing I wanted to ask about, is that the new frequency band is much higher, right? And just based on the inverse law, the inverse power law, that for every wavelength you lose...
It doesn't go through glass, let alone walls. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah, just because of the inverse power law and the way logarithmic works against the wavelength, you have to have a lot more base stations, a lot more end stations, which is why you get into things about people wanting you to mount 5G reflector antennas and stuff on your house and having them on pole tops and a lot more of them. Just
so this is, again, the two things that drive more base stations are A, capacity. So you go, as I said earlier, go through this process called cell splitting. So you have to change the repeat pattern of the frequencies, and then you can bring in another frequency band and produce an underlay layer of smaller cells. So that would be like small microcells bolted to the wall as you go up and down the street, every second or third lamppost, that kind of thing. And you also can then change the repeat pattern so that you basically, instead of having big 30-meter towers, you move down to kind of 8 to 10-meter towers, that kind of thing. And then you obviously redo the frequency repeat pattern, turn down the radio power, and that gives you more capacity. So with 5G, you are predominantly in the band now at 3.5 gigahertz for the mobile operators around the world. So 4G was at 2.6, you've now gone to 3.5. So just by the laws of physics, you are going to need to have a factor of three and a half times for the number of base stations, even allowing for all the fancy new radio modulation, the massive MIMO capabilities, the beamforming, all of that. It still comes out as it's roughly three times the number of base stations. Now, there are some 5G bands at 700 megahertz now, which gives you that kind of long range coverage and to a certain extent, building penetration. 700 megahertz will go through a wall, but that just gives you coverage. It doesn't give you capacity. So you might go through one person's wall, but you know, dad turns on the phone, mum and the kids go to turn on their phones and they haven't got enough capacity because there's only barely one channel coming into the house. It's that kind of thing.
Now, would that mostly be used for backhaul?
No. Backhaul on 5G, whereas in the past, and it varies because in the US tended to have more, less use of microwave, but across the rest of the world, 2G, 3G, 4G was all microwave last hop. So you tended to have fiber coming out from the core network to the aggregation site, to the pre-ag site, and then from the pre-ag, you go microwave out to the final base station. So in a 4G world, that microwave would be 38 gigahertz or 26 gigahertz, going roughly between 9 and 15 kilometers with a 30 centimeter to 60 centimeter dish.
And the dish is there to beam. Yeah, it's a beamform. The dish is actually a form of beamforming.
Well, this is a straight point-to-point microwave link. So
it
costs a lot of money to dig a fiber up, you know, into the middle of a field, out along next to a road or something like that. So you could get 1 gig microwaves, that's fine. Let's use the microwave. Along comes 5G and the backhaul. So on the 4G, the backhaul is called an S1 interface. On the 5G, it's an N3. And you go to at least 10 gig. So you've got at least a factor of 10 increase in what is the second most expensive part of the network, the most expensive being the radio sites themselves. So actually, a fully loaded 5G three-sector macro cell is going to produce somewhere between 11 and 15 gigs of traffic. So you're now looking at a backhaul connection from every 5G macro cell as you get a high population of 5G devices. So, you know, iPhone 12, Samsung S21, that sort of thing. As once you get a reasonable proportion of your high users using those new phones, you're going to have 2 times 10 gig backhaul, which means microwave's out the window. You can't use it anymore. So now you have not only have a lot more sites, you have to run fiber to all your existing sites and all the new sites. So there's a lot more use of fiber coming into 5G, which is another big change. Now, the other massive change is that up until 4G, the radios only needed a frequency timing synchronization signal. And that's used by, you put the frequency synchronization in, I think 16 parts per billion. That feeds into the base station and locks the radio oscillator so that it doesn't wander from the frequency it's been told to be at. So in a 4G cell, 2.6 gigahertz, you know, don't move from 2.6 to 2.62. Because if you do, you'll be on the same frequency as the next cell and you'll be a direct interference and no one will be able to hand over, make a call, etc. So they lock the cells using the frequency. When you get to 5G, actually, it should have been in 4G advanced as well, LTE advanced, but that was an optional upgrade for the operators. When you get to 5G, there is so much coordination going on, particularly at the edge of cell, but where a device, your handset, is talking to not just the cell you're on, but the cell you're going to be on in terms of the handover. There's so much coordination between those two cells to get the radio to work that you now need a phase timing signal as well. And that phase timing signal on the backhaul is class B timing, goes into the base station at plus or minus 1.1 microseconds of phase. Now, that's another massive change in the network, because if you built your network for 4G, and you were using Cisco ASR901s, ASR903s, and ASR9Ks in the AG, pre-AG, and cell site router areas, you can't use them anymore because they don't support phase timing. If you used Huawei PTN, no phase timing. If you use Nokia 7705, 7750, no phase timing. Had we ever built up a Juniper installed base of ACX 1K, 2K, you know, and ACX 500s plus the MXs at the pre-AG and stuff, we'd have been fine because we did support phase timing. Alas, we didn't. But now what you've got in there is the Cisco NCS products, the new Huawei and the Nokia ones are X-Hall and Anyhall, I think they call them. They all now support phase timing. But you've had to go, as you roll out your 5G base station network, you've had to upgrade not just the bandwidth, you've had to upgrade the actual routers as well, so that you can basically move to phase timing. So another massive change in the network to be able to roll 5G.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about beamforming, because you've said that, I've said that, and a lot of people don't know that. I know it's coming up in Wi-Fi 6, and people don't understand it. I mean, my first exposure to beamforming was dish-type radar systems, right? And then after that, there was a rotational antenna on a TACAN that I worked on that used physical beamforming. Again, it was an LDP that was, and we also had LDPs on the lock periodic dipoles on the ILS system.
Sounds like you know more about it than I do.
No, maybe not. But, and then the most interesting one was when we replaced the TACAN antenna with a fixed antenna that had four quadrants, and it did beamforming just digitally, like just using the backscatter and everything off of a non-rotating antenna, which I assume is the same kind of technology that 5G.
Basically, all the stuff about electronic steerable antennas, phased array antennas, being able to effectively create a specific part of the antenna that's forming a beam from the base station to the device, enables you to tightly control the power on that specific direction and then effectively reuse that spectrum at a different power in a beam going in a completely opposite direction off the same antenna. Right. That's effectively what it's doing. And that's where you get things like MIMO, multiple into multiple output, and now massive MIMO, which again is another big change in the 5G networks, because the antennas have to be changed for massive MIMO, but they're also heavier. So you go from by about factor of five, so you've got to do some tower strengthening as well. So again, another cost. But that's what the beamforming's doing. Now, I'm not into the dark arts of antenna design, so I'm not going to go start spouting as to how beamforming is done. But that's basically what you're doing. You're now, instead of sending a wide beam across the whole expanse of the sector of the cell, you're now forming specific beams from your electrical phased array antenna to the device, and being able to use a different part of the same antenna to effectively focus the same power or different powers to be able to deliver that device optimum radio.
Okay, right. So it's just another way of drawing down the scope of that so if you think of the air as just a shared medium, right? Mm. And all you're really doing is trying to reduce your impact of how much of that shared medium you're using physically, both by increasing frequency, decreasing power, which gives you a smaller size, so that, you know, just physically smaller footprint.
You're playing with power, you're playing with distance, you're playing with all the different spectrum you've got available to you to minimize interference. So you minimize error on the radio channel, so you maximize the bandwidth available to a given device so that your customer experience is great and the customers therefore stay on your network, use it more, but don't churn off to another network. So, you know, it's at the end of the day, radio spectrum is a finite resource. It's not like in a fixed network where you have the pain of digging up the road to put the fiber in. But once you have fiber there, you can light it with ever more optical capability. Effectively, you've got a lot more to play with.
Yeah. So beamforming, higher frequency, lower power, more sites. The other thing that's interesting about 5G, I think, is the whole disaggregation, software-defined radio. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stuff going on in that space in the 5G that is quite fascinating for people, because you don't think of something like a software-defined radio. Like, you know, the radio is an appliance, right? I mean, that now, of course, yeah, but I mean, that's kind of a strange thing for people to think about, is this whole concept of it.
So if you kind of look at a base station cabinet, what you've got in there is you've got the baseband unit, which is basically where the transmission comes in from the core network. So that's your IP transmission. You've also got the IPsec capability quite often on the base station as well. The next thing it hits is the radio modulation and signaling control cards, 4G, 5G, 2G, whatever. So today we tend to have a thing called an SRAN base station, a single RAN, where you've got a common baseband unit and then different modulation cards for each radio generation. And then you go into the linear power amplifier, which is basically the that counts for about 30% of the cost of the base station. And then it goes whizzing off up to the top of the tower to the antennas to be radiated. And you've got all the splitters and combiners and stuff that enable you to have multiple sectors and multiple antennas coming into the same heliax, which is the cylindrical waveguide that takes it back down to the base station. So what they've done is the first step was to look at what's called VRAN or possibly Cloud RAN, so virtual RAN or Cloud RAN. That's taking that base station function and breaking it apart. And broadly speaking, you now have three functions. You have the radio unit, which is the power amplifier, can be known as the active antenna unit, the AAU, where the antenna and the radio unit are stuck together. And then you have the distributed unit, which is one end of the radio modulation. And then you have the central unit, which is the other end of the radio modulation. So that sort of 2G, 3G, whatever it is, 5G card has now been broken apart. And some of the functionality resides close to or at the radio unit site. Could be in a cabinet at the bottom of the tower, could be in a street cabinet with several radios and lampposts as you go up the street. And then the central unit goes more centrally. So that is Cloud RAN. And the way it was implemented was pretty much different according to whether it was Nokia, Huawei, Samsung, Ericsson. They've all got their own Cloud RAN or virtual RAN products. Then along comes a community in both the Telecom Infra Project, TIP, and in the ORAN Alliance, the Open RAN Alliance, looking at Open RAN. So how do I decide on the splits of the functionality such that I can have different vendors concentrating on different parts of this functional chain and know that they will be able to interoperate. So interfaces and functional splits now defined in TIP and in Open RAN based on the original standards created by 3GPP. So you've now got the ORAN Alliance across multiple working groups. Juniper's in Working Group 2, which is the RIC Working Group. We're in Working Group 6, which is the Cloud one, and Working Group 9, which is the Transport one. You've got the Telecom Infra Project side of Open RAN as well. And hence, you've now got these plethora of companies coming out. The three dominant ones at the moment, AltioStar, Mavenir, Parallel Wireless, producing Open RAN. So if you break down a Mavenir solution, you've got radio units in 5G that come from either Benatel from Ireland, Bicells from supposedly Texas, but they're actually Chinese, or Sunwave, who are actually Chinese. And then you've got the DU and the CU software coming from Mavenir. If you go to AltioStar, they do the DU and the CU software, but they plug in somebody else's radio. So the radio units in Rakuten, for instance, are either Airspan for millimeter wave or NEC for the 3.5 gigahertz.
What was the original motivation to split the RAN? Was it to accelerate innovation? Was there some performance gain?
Okay, so originally the idea was, it was kind of the radio guys wondering if we could do the same in radio that the core guys have supposedly managed to do in NFV. So, you know, if you think about NFV, the idea was if I can get everything out of dedicated hardware from Ericsson MSC and Ericsson EPC and Nokia IMS, all of these different things, and run it as a VM on a holistic telco cloud, then I can save money because I'm not paying for all this specific hardware. I just rack and stack servers. Now, very few operators have actually successfully delivered a holistic telco cloud across multiple functions. And there's a whole host of reasons for that. The radio guys kind of looked at this and said, well, maybe we can do the same thing. Maybe we can move towards generic hardware and use software and accelerate innovation, reduce cost, blah, 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 blah. The reduced cost bit is yet to be proven. The guys in Rakuten reckon they can save somewhere between 40 and 60% on the cost of a radio network, which, given that is the most expensive part of any mobile network, is a big claim. But again, they're only saying it. They're not saying, here's the spreadsheets. The other one is to drive innovation. So that is now being linked very closely to supply chain security. So the US has banned Huawei and banned NEC, ZTE. But you never really had a massive installed base of a problem with either of those Chinese vendors. Europe has started to either, like the UK, say no more Huawei, or has been kind of whispering in the ears of their operators and saying, don't use Huawei, move away from them. But of course, that just leaves you with a duopoly of Ericsson and Nokia. And a duopoly is not necessarily a good thing either. So how do you bring in new vendors? How do you stimulate innovation for those new vendors? Well, Open RAN is being seen as the way to do that. And actually, the move away from Huawei has been the biggest driver to accelerate the use of Open RAN in the last 12, 18 months. So you've got big organizations like Deutsche Telekom running trials. Telefonica has already done its RFP. We did the Deutsche Telekom RFI just before Christmas. British Telecom with EE, their RFI was just before Christmas. Vodafone did their RFP at the end of 2019. They're about to start rolling out a large number of O-RAN cells. There are various other ones around the world. Rakuten is obviously the poster child of the true kind of cloud native.
So it's interesting that it's cloud native, because we always in networking have this thing about needing to have the network work to make the network work.
Mm.
Yeah. So there's a little bit of a, you know, there's a little bit of a, I wonder how that's actually going to work out in case there's an internet outage, you actually take down the cell phone network while you're at it, sort of a thing.
Just because it's cloud doesn't mean it's internet. Okay. Basically what you're doing is the DU and CU are defined as software functions that are Kubernetes workloads. So you now have to have server capability at or near the base station for the DU and in some edge functionality for the CU. Now, where that edge cloud is depends on the topology and topography of the network, the amount of fiber you've got access to, et cetera, et cetera. So it varies according to different operators. But broadly speaking, it's either going to be at the old aggregation layer or it's going to be at the pre-aggregation layer. And you will build a CU edge cloud that is running a Kubernetes CAS system and is able to run all the systems to support at least the central unit, possibly even the distributed unit, because obviously some radios are going to be closer to the edge cloud, and hence you just put the DU in it as well. And therefore, you can now run these radio units on a cloud. Now, the next thing you've got to take into account is, as I said earlier, bandwidth design. So the backhaul is 2 × 10 gig. That's the bit from the CU up to the core network. That used to be the bottom of the base station to the core network. Now that CU is handling multiple DUs. Each of those DUs is handling multiple RUs. So instead of having a 2 × 10 gig from every base station, what you now got is a probably 100 gig, maybe even 400 gig coming up from every CU site going up to the core. Going out from the CU to the DU, you've got at least 25 gig Ethernet, but you've got a latency requirement under that in the terms of in the order of only about 3 or 4 milliseconds. It's pretty low, which gets you quite a long way on fiber, but still you've got to take that into account. And you have to now pass from class B timing at the backhaul to class C timing to get the nanoseconds of phase at the antenna on the RU. And that's basically because when you take that, what I said earlier, of phase timing input to the back of the base station in backhaul on 5G was plus or minus 1.1 microseconds, there was a transfer function that meant that when you came out of the antenna out towards the device, that phase timing was now at plus or minus 1.5. So now you've got a budget between 1.5 and 1.1 that's now spread not inside a cabinet and up the cable to the antenna. It's spread between a CU running on an edge cloud and an RU running quite a long way away from that edge cloud. So you now have to have a transport system that is not only higher bandwidth than the backhaul, because you're now transporting not just the payload, you're transporting some of the radio modulation, because the CU is part of the radio protocols, and you've got to convert that to class C timing. So there are, you know, it's, that's why I say cost is not necessarily proven that the O-RAN will cost less. What it does do is it gives you a choice of a lot more companies. As I say, there's AltioStar, Mavenir, Parallel Wireless, Airspan, Casa, Acceleran, Fnet. You know,
yeah, I mean, vendor diversity is its own vendor diversity, while keeping the same control plane and tooling that you've built to manage the network and understand the network telemetry and stuff, is its own reward. in
it
many
is,
ways.
But you, we don't you think now about have it. The new area of the kind of the radio SI coming in. Because it, what you look at, if you look at the different use cases for the radio, you've got 4G, you've got 5G non-standalone, you've got 5G standalone, you've got indoor, outdoor, and then you've got different radio powers. So you've got like sub 1 watt, 1 watt, 5 watt, 10 watt, whatever. And you look at all the different companies and no one O-RAN company covers the whole range, not even Samsung or NEC. So if you want to be able to build a network on O-RAN technology across all the, even a smaller subset of the capabilities that you need, you now need to integrate multiple vendors and do integrations between their kit. So that means the SI role becomes quite important in the radio side of things.
Right. This is the downside. We always talk about the upside of software defined, right? You get a lot more choice. The downside of software defined is, guess what? You get a lot more choice.
Well,
I mean, because anybody can fork it or create a new product that runs on the hardware that's so much better than whatever has gone before.
So this is where it gets interesting from a Juniper point of view, because obviously we've built up business in the telco cloud space with Contrail Cloud and Contrail Networking. And the uptake on holistic cloud that's running, you know, an IMS from Nokia and an EPC from Ericsson and, you know, various other functions from other vendors hasn't been as massive as people would have thought. You know, VMware's got a certain amount of business and, you know, other distributions have got business as well. But what's not understood there is that these are all core network functions that have signaling. And there is a very carefully controlled process when you bring in a new level of software on an IMS, because that's connecting to the DEPC, which is connecting to the HSS. And if you screw up on a signaling interface, you bring down the network very quickly and your CEO is on the news explaining to the country why your network's dead. When you then add an SDN layer, a hypervisor, a server, an operating system, you're adding three, four, five levels of extra complexity to what is already a very conservative process for rolling out new stuff in the network. Now, whilst it sounds like the radio is going to be very complicated with RU, DU, CU, the effect of any one failure is a lot smaller because you've moved the cloud further out. So you might be covering a small town with 10 base stations. If you lose a small town, it's bad for the member, you know, the customers in that town. But you don't lose the whole network because the signaling impacts don't necessarily go as far as they would in a core network site. So what's actually going to happen is that as you roll out those edge clouds based on Kubernetes, so things like you know, Robin.io's platform or Wind River and their Starling X platform, you know, the stuff in VMware, et cetera, they will get used for Kubernetes for the CU and DU. And then in the next couple of years, as 3GPP release 16 comes along and we get the 5G standalone core being deployed by mobile operators with the AMF, SMF, and UPF, which are, again, all Kubernetes functions, instead of looking to what they've already deployed in a virtual machine space using OpenStack and VMware, they'll look to what they've already deployed in the radio on Kubernetes CAS distributions and say, well, why don't we just use that in the core as well? So the choice that's being made now for the Open RAN Edge Cloud will dominate the telco cloud in the next 2 years.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, they become cloud operators. Mm-hmm. They have to do their job well. And so why not use that to bring in other revenue?
Well, then you get the next level of opportunity happening where you're seeing the hyperscalers coming out with versions of their capability in smaller pods and opening up to running RAN functions and core functions on AWS or, you know, even Microsoft buying two different mobile core vendors, Metaswitch and Affirmed. You now get Affirmed on Azure for telcos and Metaswitch on Azure Edge. So, you know, you can roll out a full EPC, 5G standalone core and IMS on Azure. And, you know, they will have different versions of how you consume that cloud. As to how successful they'll be, will remain to be seen.
And the other side of that is it opens up the revenue possibility of having a CDN colo on the same cloud, you know, physical hardware, really, really close to the edge.
Mm-hmm. Etsy's independent specification group for multi-access edge computing, which was formed in December 2015. That's where that started. It was an internal Vodafone project called Savvy Smart Access Vision to put caching on the 4G base stations because they were seeing the growth in video traffic and the impact that that was going to have on backhaul and the core costs. So they worked out if they could put caching on the base stations, that would dramatically reduce the overall cost of the network. That was the theory. The practice was that obviously you have to come up with a way of opening the GTP protocol at the edge without upsetting all the core network signaling, hence the MEC standards. But also now you've got to add x86 capability to every base station. So in a country the size of the UK, you've probably got, each operator's got, what, 20,000 base stations, 2,000 pre-ag, 200 ag, and about 5 to 10 core sites. So you're looking at 20,000 base stations. By the time you finish putting the 20,000th x86 installation, you go back and have to start the other one because it's now out of date, it's not got enough memory, it needs more processing power. So you never stop going around changing x86. So very rapidly you realize the best place to put the edge cloud is not the base station itself, apart from certain key use cases, you know, campus occasionally, you know, that kind of thing. There's a small number of cases where it makes sense to put it on the macro cell. What the best place to put it is actually on the edge cloud in the pre-ag, because the pre-ag is only 2 milliseconds away. So you lose a little bit of latency, but you gain, you now only have 2,000 sites to deal with as opposed to 20,000 sites.
What's really fascinating about all of this is that I actually went through designs of this kind working on Telepost Greenland, because they have villages all over the place that have no, all they have is microwave. Yeah. So how do you get content? I mean, these people out there want to have telemedicine and they want to have video on demand, and they're in a village of 26 people, you know, that's three hops down a microwave link. And the only way to do it is to put the data in a cabinet in the village.
Well, that's exactly, they're still doing that. So there's now projects to feed build an edge cloud in a rural location, either using etcmec or with a UPF on in that edge cloud, so you can break out the GTP. You still have a signaling link over a satellite back to the core, and you feed the content into an edge CDN, and you feed all of the other applications into an edge application environment via the satellite during, you know, when it's not busy. And the people in the village can still get access to pretty much everything. So, there's European Space Agency projects called SAT-IN 5G. There's various other ones. BT, for instance, are using satellite backhaul for 5G base stations in rural Scotland and stuff like that, or at least satellite backup for the backhaul and stuff like that. So those same concepts are still around.
Awesome. Well, I think we'll break it off there. We'll plan another session on 5G and talk more detail perhaps in a couple of weeks or a month or something, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
And Tom, where can people get in touch with you and or look at your non-existent writing or whatever the case might happen to be?
You can look at my non-existent writing in your mind, whatever you want it to be. That's what I'll say. But I'm on LinkedIn at Tom Ammon and Twitter at the same.
All right. And Ian, do you blog on juniper.net or on your own blog or any place?
They don't let me do things like that. So
the best way
to get hold of me is to just get me on Teams or bung me an email. So
okay, cool. All right. I'm Russ White. You can always find me here at the Hedge, rule11.tech, blah, 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 blah. You can find me. Just don't PM me on Twitter. I say that every show and people still PM me on Twitter and I don't know why, but it's fine. All right, and we'll catch you next time on The Hedge.
Subscribe to The Hedge on your favorite podcast service or follow along at rule11.tech.